being that we had, thanks to Yanti, we got to see incredible people. I tell people that where we were and who we saw, and they're like, wow, who took you guys around? I'm like, if you only understood, we were very blessed. That's not the only thing, but that's just one of the things. But we also had the privilege last Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos, to go to Hebron and to the tomb of the patriarchs, and also to the tomb of Rachel, and especially the tomb of the patriarchs. This week there were 40,000 Jews that were there for Shabbos. Because this weekend we read from the Torah portion talks about when Abraham goes, right, Chayesar, Abraham purchases that piece of land to bury Sarah. So I thought that it would be apropos, we're getting together for us to see everybody. It was such a, you know, it's like, thank God nothing's changed, we're still together. Mm-hmm. And then we get to add on even better, we get to add on our better halves.
Well said.
The question really is that you go to a place like Hebron, which has there are four holy cities. There's Jerusalem, Hebron, and then we went up north, Sfat and Tveria, the other two. So we actually hit three out of the four. We actually probably went through Tveria if we were probably sleeping through it, or Alan was busy giving us a lecture on
it.
Okay, there you go. So we hit the big four. But the question really is what's so special about Hebron? And really the what it is actually really connecting back to Abraham and Sarah, and then their children, Isaac, Rebecca, and then Jacob and Rachel and Leah. So you have these holy people. There are parents, there are grandparents. That we all here, that's where we come from. And so to understand who they were, I thought let's just like do a little bit, a small piece of the Rambam. Maimonides brings down he has what we call the Yad Chazaka. There are 14 books that really comprise everything. They cover every subject matter in the Jewish religion. And the Rambam, Maimonides, lived in the 1200s, and he really, it's incredible clarity. He codifies the Jewish law. And in there, he usually doesn't really talk about, like he doesn't go on prose and talk about and describe certain things. He's really about just decisive and giving us laws. So when he does, in that context, give us more flowery or descriptions of things or stories, it's kind of strange. And he does this in a couple of different places. One of those places is in the laws of which we have here, foreign worship and customs of the nations, basically the laws against idol worship. And he describes the derivation or the history of idol worship, of how the nations of the world ran after idols and worshiping foreign gods and things like that. And then he then introduces us to Abraham. And I wanted to look at this together because it kind of gives us an understanding what this all, how it started, how where we come from. What, you know, when we talk about the Jewish nation being a light to the nations, what is it that what kind of light are we? What are we trying to represent? What are we trying to convey and teach to the other, to the nations of the world? We want to bring light. We want to illuminate the world. So what are we trying to, what's that message? Is it just that we should be nice people? There are plenty of nice people out there. We don't have a monopoly on being ethical and nice. So what is it that Abraham was really running after? So in this piece here that I just, I copied for everybody, I wanted to read through it. And then, so you get a sense of what Abraham was fighting for, what his message was, what he brought to the world. And the truth is that most of the major religions of the world are predicated on Abraham's mission. Even though I want to mention also Christianity in this context, we'll understand. We had this crazy story with Jack. Jack meets this guy up north. Oh. Right? That incredible story. Jack, so what happens? That one of the guys on the trip, we go up the first night, we're on a time base. And one of the guys from Brooklyn, he meets this soldier, a lone soldier from Hawaii.
And Alex.
It was Alex? Yeah, his name's Alex.
David,
okay.
David, right.
So he meets David Freeman from Hawaii, and he's excited because this guy is the sweetest guy. He's like, wow, I want to set you off with my daughter. He has an 18-year-old daughter. He's all excited about this. Fast forward, Friday afternoon, we're in Jerusalem, and he sees David Freeman. Here we're up in the Golan Heights, you know, hours away, and then Friday afternoon, he sees this David again. He runs after him. David, this is meant to be. You have to go with my daughter. And then fast forward to Shabbos afternoon, he finds out that David's family are Jews for Jesus. And I was like, boom. Like, that was the end of that, that was the end of that, right? And you could see that and I've told the story to people, and we're all like, maybe we can convert them back and get them off the Jesus thing, you know? But the question is, what is the issue? What is the issue that we have with Christianity? It's important for people to understand, okay? All right, so let's read this piece of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. I'll read it quickly, and then we'll see within this, we have to understand what it is, the issue is. I mean, we look for commonality with people of the world, and you know, we want to see how we connect with all people, but we also have a message, and it's a very important message, and after going through this, I'm going to explain to you, there's a point of why this is so important. You know, where you start, the foundations of things are so important, because if you have the wrong foundation, the house will collapse, the building collapses. So I'm going to explain to you the point that's most important here, and then we can become a light to the nations, to ourselves, and to our families, and to other Jews, and then et cetera, et cetera. So it says like this. Now I'm taking this, it's chapter 1, or chapter, 1 Halacha 3. I didn't put that down. So as soon as this giant, Abraham, was weaned, he commenced to busy his mind. In his infancy, he commenced to think by day and by night and would encounter this enigma. How is it possible that this planet should continuously be in motion and have no leader? And who indeed causes it to revolve, it being impossible that it should revolve itself? So he's looking at the world. It says that he was 3 years old when he started this journey. Some say that he finally got to the answer at 3, or maybe at 40, 48, 52. There are different opinions. But the idea is that he started at a very young age, bothered by this idea of what is going on. There must be something behind this world. What is making this world operate? Moreover, he neither had a teacher nor one to impart it to him. For he was sunk in awe of the Chaldeans, or his awe custom in Hebrew, among the foolish worshippers of stars. And his father and his mother, like all the people, worshipped stars. And he, although following them in their worship, busies his heart and reflects until he attains the path of truth. And by his correct thinking, he understood when he finally saw the line of righteousness. He knew that there is one God, he leads the planet. He created everything, and in all that there is no God save he, meaning there's only one God. He knew that the whole world was in error, and that the thing which caused them to err was that their worshiping the stars and the images brought about the loss of the truth from their consciousness. So he basically understood that the idea of having multiple, like what's the importance of having one God? We have to understand that. So if you look at the world and you say there is a power, but you break it up into parts instead of being one unity that's all encompassing, then what you're saying is that if it's a multiplicity of powers, then there's nothing that you're not obligated to it. You don't have to subjugate yourself to that. You're equal to that God, because the God has powers, but it lacks in other respects. But if you understand that God is one and is a perfect one, that there's nothing lacking in God, God is always the same, it's always perfect. So that is something that at that point, when you understand the oneness of God, you have to subjugate yourself to that all-powerful one, and that it's never changing. It's a different thing than what we are. If we want to, in a certain sense, idol worship is a projection of self, that we can see, just like we know that we have limitations, if we project that onto a God, then God is limited and has lacks, just like we do. But the idea, the understanding, what Abraham came to, what he discovered, he said, it can't be, I am actually a limited being, but there is something that's out there that is unlimited. Once you recognize that there is that great being out there that is unlimited, is perfect, etc., etc., then you subjugate, you understand your limitations. You don't say that you're not capable, where we try to expand ourselves to the nth degree. We try to max out our potential, but we recognize that there's a power that's greater, and we subjugate ourselves to that perfect oneness, which is God. So Abraham's looking and he sees that what was going on in the world was that they took this power and they broke it up into pieces. And therefore, they could, say, okay, this statue is invested with certain powers. I'm going to pray to that power, but understanding that power is lacking in certain respects also. So I'm equal with the God. What he came to understand is by understanding the oneness and that all-powerful God, I have to subjugate and I have to bow myself to that perfect one God. And then everything, and understand that there's something that's beyond ourselves. And that's what the Torah really comes to teach us, is it gives us the knowledge. God gave us over a base of knowledge that we could tap into that's greater than ourselves, that is beyond our normal comprehension.
So the thing is that insofar as that the God of the tree lacks certain qualities, I lack certain qualities, therefore we're equal.
Correct.
And this whole concept, Abraham brought the concept as, no, I'm willing to subjugate myself to something that's higher and more powerful, that has all qualities.
Correct.
It lacks in nothing.
Correct. Exactly.
I just want to say that I don't understand yet the concept of fear in Judaism with vis-a-vis mm-hmm. Hashem. But when you break it up into different pieces, you could like pick and choose. Like, okay, this idol has the power of fertility. I don't need it. I'll go here. And so there's no fear in not subjugating yourself to that idol, because there are other idols and you really don't care about that quality. So again, I don't understand fear in our relationship with Hashem, but when you break it up like that, I think you're taking away something that is in our prayer books constantly, and that is the fear concept.
Right, so the fear, so I just did this today. I'm studying with someone, Tanya. So Tanya is the book that
before
is...
Before this?
What?
Today?
Yeah.
Good job.
That's very
early. Yeah. Start early.
You probably didn't have to drive an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the morning, yeah. So you have everybody's familiar with Chabad. Chabad is Lubavitch, right? Chabad stands for Chachma Bina Das. It's the basis of it's an ideology that was started from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was a student of the Baal Shem Tov. He wrote a book called Tanya. It's referred to as Tanya. In there, one of the things that he talks about is God as the Ein Sof, the Endless One. It's a meditation. When you start thinking about, if we start thinking about the universe and black holes and just thinking of the endlessness of the universe, so the Tanya talks about the idea of God as the endless one. It's kind of like a meditation. You start thinking about God as unlimited. When you start thinking about God as unlimited, that kind of gets you to the idea of awe. That's fear. And there's fear. There are different levels of fear. There's a lower type of fear. There's higher levels of fear. But of idea of God is awesome, right? So then that gets a certain,
respect.
Right, respect and different, the awe, whatever. But that's that category of, as opposed to love, it begets a certain type of fear that one would get. Okay, so just back to here. So then Abraham discovers this. And when Abraham was 40 years old, he recognized his creator. After he came to this comprehension and knowledge, he started to confute the sons of Ur, the Chaldeans, their custom, and to organize disputations with them, cautioning them, saying, "This is not the true path that you are following." And he destroyed the images and commenced preaching to the people, warning them that it is not right to worship any save the God of the universe. And unto him alone it is right to bow down, to offer sacrifices and compound offerings, so that the creatures of the future shall recognize him. Meaning that he was going out and he was just, that's all he did. He was going around traveling and trying to explain to people this concept. You have it all wrong. And he supposedly wrote this idea that Abraham, was it? That
they, it's a miracle they didn't try.
So they tried to. Yeah. So that's the story. So that eventually he became a problem. To the point where Nimrod, Nimrod actually takes him. It doesn't say it anywhere, but we understand it from, we derive it from the fact that it's Ur Kasdim. Ur is a fire. Chaldeans, so it's like the fire of the Chaldeans. So the rabbis understood that there was this, that Nimrod, who was the leader of this world, it was basically like in a certain sense like a communist type of society where everybody had to think the same way. And he said, "Abraham, you're a problem. You're causing issues here." And he said, which God are you going to bow down to? And Abraham said, there's only one God, and I'm not bowing down to any of these. And so basically, or constant, is he threw him into the fire. He said the fire God threw him in, and he survived miraculously. So Abraham definitely had help from a higher power, which is God. What's interesting is that Sarah's dad was there with Abraham, and he said, they asked him, okay, who are you bowing down to? He said, well, he survived the fire. I'm going to go with that. I'm on the fire one, you know? So they throw him into the fire and he burns because either you're in or you're not. So God's like, if you're all in, I'll save you, but not. And he ends up burning in there. And Abraham ends up marrying Sarah. Well, there's a whole long... There's a story behind that. So it perhaps is the first story of Yibum but we're not going to go there right now. But you see this idea. So for our takeaway, if we're going to, you know, it's something to think about because we're so far from this idea. But going back and read through this, take it home and think about this idea, what it means that God's one, the perfect one. This is our whole religion is predicated on this. And the truth is Islam is on the same page. Christianity, the problem with Christianity is that they've taken this and they... Now all of a sudden you have a trinity. That to us is a problem. Ridiculous. Right? Because once you start, any time that you go away from the perfect oneness, you have a problem. So if you confront a Christian, and there's some, I mean, I've had these discussions.
Yeah, all the Marys and the bathtubs on the front lawn. I mean,
hello. Right? Right. So if you start talking to Christians about this stuff, they will start. Oh no, it's one. It's one. How is it
but
one?
It's his father. It's his
right,
son.
Right. So you see, it's a problem. So that where we in Judaism, you'll see that God, we describe God's actions. There are multiple ways of describing God as the God of you know this and that, but never that God Himself is anything but one. Okay, so this is a very important point. So when we were together in Hebron, so this is where they ended up. They started out, all this is happening actually probably either in Syria, Iraq, like we have to like look at the maps to figure out where they came from, and then they eventually come down into Israel, and Israel becomes the place when God says to Abraham, I want you to go for you to this place. And just as a side at the bottom here, we see that Terach, Abraham's father, also started going towards Canaan, towards the land of Israel, but didn't make it there. But Abraham eventually gets there. And when Sarah dies, it says that she died in Hebron. So where we were last Saturday night, it was where Sarah was when she passed away. They lived in Kiryat Arba, they lived in that area. So we were traveling where these great people, where our ancestors who started it all, we were there. And being in the land of Israel, what God is saying to Abraham is, I want you to go to this place. This is the place that is for a Jew. We want to aspire to be there because it's a place that's conducive for us to become the most that we've become. When we go to Israel, so Israel is the seat of creation. When we were looking, when we were at Palmela's and we were looking out at the Dome of the Rock, there's a rock there. That's the accretion stones underneath there, where God created the world. It's from that place. It's the seat of creation. Now, just as if you look at the book of Genesis, that first line is that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then what? It says that the world was chaotic. V'ha'aretz ha'isa tohu v'vohu, the world was in chaos. The seat of creation, Israel, the land, is a place that is the most, it has the most of what creation was, which was chaos. When you're in Israel, there's a certain chaotic energy.
Yes.
Okay? But it's that which is conducive to creation. That's where creation happened. That's where it all, so that we as Jews, it might be unsettling, and that's why, by the way, the story with the spies when they came, the 12 spies, that they came back with kind of a negative report because they couldn't handle the chaos. They felt unsettled by that. They were great, incredible people, but there was a certain, they were unsettled because it's something, it's a crazy energy that you have there. But it's the place that God says to Abraham, that's the place that you will become the most, you'll become you. The one thing that that God does not have, of all the things, God has everything but one thing. He doesn't have us, and what we can do is become ourselves. That's the only thing that God does not have that we can give him. When God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, He's speaking to everybody, to all of us. He's saying, I want you to become you. I want you to go to become you, lecha, and to be the most that you can be. That's all that you can give me, because I have everything else. And where? In the land of Israel, because that's the place of that. It's the most conducive to becoming the most. So we here, we're sitting here in Teaneck, New Jersey, but we just experienced a week ago, and we're supposed to aspire to always want to be there and to try to live there, or at least aspire to be there, have our minds being there, because that's tapping into the place of becoming, of creation, of becoming, creating ourselves the most that we can be. So that's step one. That is Abraham and his idea. The monotheism is built here. We were there in that place. We got to be there. And so that's one, I think, important takeaway. If you turn over, I just want to show you a very cool lesson that we had yesterday's parsha.
I just want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. I think I found interesting about the difference between a Christian or an idol worshiper would do versus one who believes in the Torah, is that you can only, if you limit your conception of a God, that's a limitation on your relationship with that God. It can only be anything. It can only be as big as that idea represents to you. So what happens with Judaism, it's all about a relationship in its fullest context. So if you start to limit that context by putting something on a wall representing it, it will limit your ability to relate to it, because it's bounded by what you then have pictured to be. That's why I think Judaism is so against idol worship, depictions of graven images or anything, because what it does, it might be that the pagans might have been able to relate to it better. That's why I think they did it with the statues of Jesus and all these different things, because they were able to hold on to it. So for us, it's harder to hold on to an image of God, which is big. On the other hand, it gives us the biggest ability to relate to him. And him, her, everybody. I'm going to get into that again. that's what Judaism is about. Everything in life is a context of connection. And it really comes down to the fact that we see it as that oneness. Oneness, that idea of infinity that Abraham brought in the world, revolutionized religious thought. Just absolutely revolutionized it. We wanted it. We keep it pristine, because that's the, even though it's hard sometimes to concretize, that's the challenge, but it gives us the ability to connect with every aspect of life.
So I just to add on to that, there are two things that I saw recently. It says, when we say God's name, we say Adonai, which means our master, but it's not spelled that way, because the real name of God is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. We don't pronounce it ever. So I was reading, and the person explained that, why don't we say that name? So the answer is that by uttering that, we create limitation. And so that name, which is the transcendental, that represents God as, it was in the past, in the present, in the future. He means he's above time. God is not limited by the physical reality, right? Exactly. So that, why don't we pronounce, exactly this point, we create some kind of potential limitation, therefore we never utter that name. The only place that we would utter it is in the temple, because in the temple, which is above space and time, you could actually utter it, because it would never be, there's no limitation there. Yeah. And that's Rav Kook also says, that when you have an atheist, if you meet someone who says, I don't believe in God, I say, you're right, I'm with you, because I don't believe in the God that most people create, because they create gods of limitation, so we also don't believe in that, because it's really a challenge. It's not easy. This is not easy stuff. If it was so easy, everybody would be doing it. So that's a challenge. As adults, like, we're like, okay, this is not easy stuff, but the idea is that, just also, this was yesterday, not this morning, but I was learning the Maharal, and the Maharal talks about the idea that we are on a spiritual plane. We're all potential. And our task, God is expecting from us to always max out that potential. Mm. We need to constantly, so you could be 99, 119, you're on the deathbed, and you're like, God's like, come on, you still got a little bit more. Come on, push it. On a spiritual plane, we're all potential, and God's saying to us, come on, you did what? That's nothing. Let's go. Keep on pushing. There's more. We think we're like adults, that we've done it. No, we're like little children. God is expecting us to constantly push and get more and more and more and grow. You think you're good? No. More. And so that's until the final you know, breath, we're constantly tasked to push ourselves a little more. Okay.
For someone who's about to turn 60, that's good.
You know, I went to, I learned this from, I saw this firsthand. This, well, you saw Rabbi Gamliel, the guy was, how old he is. How old is he?
He's just 77.
He's like he's 15 years old. He's jumping around. I mean, that guy's got energy, right? He's just like, you felt that. But I have a rabbi that I learned from him. Like, he's like a little boy. He's so excited because he's constantly coming up with new ideas and he's constantly pushing himself to grow. And that's where we're all, where we're all supposed to be. So that's, okay, so one other quick idea from yesterday's parsha. So after Abraham buries Sarah and mourns for her, it says that he brings his servant and he asks him to go find a wife for his son Isaac. And he sends him back to the old country. And Isaac couldn't leave the land of Israel, so he sends Eliezer to go and do this thing. So now, we're not going to read through this, so don't worry. What I did here is, if you look at it quickly, there's a thing that pops out. There's the most times in the whole Torah it says the word camels. It's like camel this and camel that and camel this and camel that. And it's funny because I picked up Rav Pinchas Friedman. He wrote this week, what's with the camels? You know, like, here you're going to go, you want to make the first, you want to find a proper mate for someone. Why? What's the fixation with camels? Like, really strange. So okay, they live in a desert area, so their camels are important, but like, okay, enough with the camels. So in the Torah there is one person that is recorded that a person was cameled. Okay, cameled, yeah, which I know it's not a real word, but I'm playing it, but in Hebrew I'm translating it literally. Okay, it says that when Isaac was weaned, biyom higamel Es Yitzchak, the day that Isaac was weaned. But it says it in Hebrew, he gamel, which is the same root word as camel. Camel is gamal. Biyom he gamel es Yitzchak, the day that Yitzchak was weaned, he was cameled. That's how they use the word. I'm translating literally so you get the sense of what, because sometimes things are lost in translation. The question is, what does camel...
What's the verb camel mean?
Right, so I'm making it up. It's not really. It's weaned, right?
Oh, my English Hebrew word for weaned.
Weaned is ligamel.
The word is weaned. Okay.
It's a weaned. Okay. So the literal translation, I'm playing around, but I'm trying to make a mess. So Yankee's looking at me like, what are you doing? Like, and he just, I'm getting nothing from our Barnett. He's like, okay, so why would the Hebrew language, we call it the holy language, because... And I'll just as a side, it says fast forward that Joseph, when he was in Egypt, he had to swear to Pharaoh. And he swore to Pharaoh, I won't tell anybody that you didn't get, you were not able to understand the Hebrew language. He knew all other languages. He couldn't get the Hebrew language. Come on, if you're a linguist and you can get all the languages, why can't you get the Hebrew language? And the answer is that he can understand Hebrew on the surface, but Hebrew, in its pristine form, is layered. Like our, right, the layers of the water, right? It's layered. So we had Moshe Rothschild, right? He said that when you take the water, and when you look at the ocean, it's blue, but then when you take it out, it's translucent, but because he was teaching us this idea that there are multiple layers to things. So Hebrew is a layered language with multiple meanings and depth. So here, the fact that you'll have a word for camel to be used for weaning, there has to be a deeper connection to that. So what does weaning have to do with a camel? And why in our story here of making a mate for this young man Isaac, not so young, why is it all about the camels? Okay, and why is Isaac the camel guy? You know, what's he, it's connecting. Okay, and one of the, just the other side thing, is Abraham had a, each of the forefathers had a certain attribute that they're associated with. Abraham's thing was he was a person that did kindness. He was running around, always trying to help. We have that story where he just had his circumcision, and he's sitting by the tent running to help people. These people came, and he took them in, and he fed them. He's running. He's the man of chesed, of kindness. So here he's going to look for a mate for his child, and he's sending Eliezer out. Eliezer comes, and he's looking, who's the right girl? And then he sees Rebecca. And Rebecca comes, and she gives him water, and she's running to do, right, the camels. And she gives the camel as much water as it needs to be. So what's it about a camel? So when you give a camel enough water, I heard yesterday 53 gallons. That's what I was told.
You know?
Yeah, 53 gallons. What happens? It becomes completely independent. So what does that mean?
You can't be. You can't direct it. You can't.
It's completely. You no longer needs you. Right?
Oh. Okay.
It's completely independent. Now think about this: when someone's weaned, and a camel, when it's completely given its water, what are the two? You're creating an independence, right? The weaning the child, and a camel when it's fully full, when it's filled up to its fullest, 53 gallons, they are completely. You're creating independence. So we have a term for kindness is to do chesed. The highest form of chesed, of kindness, is gemilat chesedim, gomel chesed, camel chesed. What does it mean? It means to be able to create, you do something good for someone to the point where you create complete independence for them, that they become completely independent. It's the idea, for example, you can give a person food or you can give them a fish, but the greatest kindness is to teach them how to fish so that they become completely independent. So when they're looking for Isaac's mate, they're looking for what? They're looking for, I want to look for someone for my son. I'm going to be looking for a girl who is the person who does kindness, but not with kindness with strings attached, but she does kindness because she wants to help a person to become completely, fully independent and self-sufficient. So that the backdrop of this story, the subtle, it's like the messaging that the Torah is saying is, camels, 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 camels. Why? Because what Isaac, what Abraham and his servant were looking for is the perfect mate for Isaac. You know who Rebecca was? She was a person who understood that kindness is not with strings attached. It's camel kindness. It's creating independence in others. Okay? So that when we, and this is like, I always try to bring a lesson for ourselves, is that when we're looking for our kids to see who should be their friends or who their mate should be, when we're like trying to size that person up, what are we looking for? The Torah is saying, look for a person who's kind. Look for a person who's giving. A person who wants to help others, that looks to help, and not to do it so that they have some kind of hold over them, but to help so that they're cameled. So that they're completely independent, so that they're helping people without any strings attached. And that's like this subtle thing that you see here. When you look at this page and you see the camels, you have that message being coming through.
I just wanted just another little thing just to add that's gorgeous. I'm just thinking as you were saying it, the mothers is giving milk to the baby, right? Up until that time they're weaned. So she's providing the kindness. She's totally providing the kindness. And then when you wean, he's being weaned off her kindness. Now he's full, not just that he's fully independent, but he's fully able to give kindness now on his own. Because Gomil's chesedim, which the camel represents, and he has that water source to bring up wherever he needs to go. So now Yitzhak's not just fully independent, he's fully independent to give chesed to the world, which before he was depending on his mother for it. And Rebecca is certainly an example of that in her own right. Beautiful, though. Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we have to do a picture.